Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Never mind walking and chewing gum at the same time, as Democrats and the president have been insisting they're capable of. This week, it is all impeachment all the time. The House will debate and take a full floor vote. The White House and both parties in Congress, especially the Senate, are calculating next steps. So this hour on Point, we'll take stock of the big week ahead in Washington. And a little later this hour, we'll also talk to Democratic presidential candidate Michael Bennett. So you can join us. Will you be watching the House vote expected on Wednesday or Thursday? What's your take on how Senator Mitch McConnell says he'll run an impeachment trial in the Senate versus Senator Chuck Schumer's request for witnesses? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining me today from Washington is Paula Reed, White House correspondent for CBS News, focusing on the Justice Department and legal affairs as well. Paula, it's good to have you.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here.
Also with us is Catherine Tully McManus. She covers Congress and in particular congressional leadership for CQ Roll Call. Catherine, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So first of all, Catherine, let me start with you and let's just dive right into the House debate and vote that could come as soon as Wednesday. What do we expect there?
So the plan is for the full House to vote on Wednesday on the articles of impeachment. The rules for that debate and the vote will be laid out Tuesday in the House Rules Committee. So there is still one more committee that these articles of impeachment have to go through. But that is a Democrat-led committee, and it's really just outlining how many hours of debate and who controls the time. And then what we will likely also see is potentially impeachment managers named, which are House lawmakers who act as prosecutors when the case goes to the Senate.
And Paula, do we know at all who some of those possible names might be?
There have been some names that have been floated. Representative Amash is one name that has been floated. But at this point, it's not clear. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, she has a lot of leeway in terms of who she selects, how many she selects. And I know there has been a big push within the Democratic Party for diversity. Then the question is, well, what does that mean? Is that making sure you have an even balance of men and women, people of different races, or is it more sort of geopolitical diversity? Still a lot of open questions.
Okay. So talk to me, Paula, about how the vote itself is expected to go. Are there any wavering Democrats?
It does not appear at this point that there is any doubt that they are going to approve these two articles of impeachment. It is expected that they will both be approved. And I've been focusing more on the White House's strategy because they're not even looking at the House vote at this point. They are focused more now on a likely Senate trial. There was one big development, of course, over the weekend, which is a representative from New Jersey, a district where Trump is quite popular, a Democrat, Jeff Van Drew. He has decided that he's going to switch parties to the Republican Party. He's been sort of really the lone critic of the impeachment process. But we're hearing from our sources that he may wait to switch parties until after the impeachment vote because the president, who's been driving this decision, wants him to wait until after the impeachment vote so that he can vote no as a Democrat.
Okay. So, Catherine, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, there's definitely been one of the Republican talking points has been that the bipartisan vote on impeachment was against when they approved the rules and procedures for how this impeachment inquiry would be governed, so the committee rules and things like that. And they did have Democrats vote against those rules. And that has been a big Republican talking point. And I do think that Republicans and the president would like Jeff Van Drew to have a D next to his name when he votes no.
Okay. So presuming some grand surprise doesn't happen between now and Wednesday, I'm hearing both of you say it's pretty safe to assume that these articles of impeachment will be voted on Wednesday or Thursday in the full House, and then
will pass and could be transmitted thereafter to the Senate, right, Paula? Is that what I'm hearing?
Exactly. Now, we don't expect the Senate trial to get underway until early next year. But the big question right now is, what will that look like? And I've spoken with sources. I know that the president's top lawyer, the president's top legislative aide, they will be meeting this week with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to talk about what their best strategy is for a trial. Now, some Democrats have cried foul over the president's lawyers coordinating with GOP leadership, but they're going to continue to work together to figure out the rules, the timing, and the approach that they want to take.
Okay, so let's talk more about that in particular, because on Sunday, just yesterday, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer basically put out a request or list of demands, however you want to look at it, on how Democrats in the Senate would like the Senate trial to be run, specifically asking for witnesses. So, Catherine, can you tell us more about what Schumer wants?
Yes, Schumer put out this letter saying that he would like relevant witnesses to appear in the Senate trial, including National Security Advisor John Bolton and current acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. This is an interesting request, especially we have not heard from Majority Leader McConnell yet on how he will respond to this request, because having witnesses in the Senate opens the door for having witnesses who prove the Democrats' point as opposed to defend the president's position, and that can complicate things for the Republicans in the Senate.
So, Paula, talk about this with us, because I haven't heard a public peep from Senator Mitch McConnell that he would be open to having witnesses in his Senate-run trial here, especially the ones, as Catherine is saying, the Democrats would like to hear from. Mick Mulvaney, John Bolton, Robert Blair. None of these folks testified before the House subcommittees
to begin with. That's right. And I know from speaking with sources close to Mulvaney, he's not going to cooperate unless the White House tells him to. Otherwise, he would take a separate legal challenge based on his role as acting chief of staff to determine whether he can be compelled to testify. But Mitch McConnell's in a tricky spot here, because the president has been quite clear that he would like to have a show. He wants to call witnesses, and the witness list that he has is quite something. It's Adam Schiff, it's Hunter Biden, it's Joe Biden. It's a lot of different folks that he wants to put on the stand, because he believes the House process has not been fair, his side has not been heard. But Mitch McConnell and other officials inside the White House, they believe that when it comes to the president's defense, less is more. But so far, they've not been able to convince the president of this. So what you are likely to see is that this will get underway without a clear commitment on witnesses, because one of the things that is interesting about the impeachment process in the Senate is there is some flexibility within it. There is a little bit of decide as you go. And the hope is that the president will see the presentations, he'll see the process is more fair to him and the GOP-led Senate, and then perhaps he may back off of this desire to try to call former Vice President Joe Biden, which of course is something unprecedented and would likely wind up in the court. So that's the strategy right now. But Mitch McConnell is sending the president some not-so-subtle hints in his press conference that he wants this over with fast.
Okay, so, but Paula, tell me, say that because of what you just said, mm-hmm. that Senator McConnell says, no, we're going to run the Senate trial with no witnesses. We're just going to have, the counsels, if I can call them that, from either side, present their cases to the Senate here. I mean, is that a non-starter for Democrats? I mean, I'm seeing some rumblings of, like, if that happens, if McConnell decides to go that way, maybe Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi in the House won't transmit the impeachment proceedings to the Senate.
Sure, it's possible. But I think House Democrats have to know that the witnesses that they're talking about, for example, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, yeah, they've tried to call him. His case, that question about whether he can be compelled, that is currently tied up in the courts, a question that will likely go to the Supreme Court, whether you can be compelled to testify when the White House tries to block you. Do they want to wait months for former National Security Advisor John Bolton? Again, as I said with Mick Mulvaney, he's willing to take this question to the courts. And his attorneys, they believe quite firmly that if executive privilege or any of these privileges apply to one person in addition to the president, it's Mick Mulvaney. So if they want to die on that hill, right, and not transmit, okay. But I think everyone understands that realistically, these particular witnesses are likely to be tied up in court for quite some time before you get an answer on whether they can either cooperate.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying, Paula. But Catherine, I mean, on this show over the past several weeks, we've had folks come on and say the proceedings, the Democrats have rushed through this too fast, and that perhaps this is an opportunity again, I mean, who knows? This is like four-dimensional chess right now. But if this could be an opportunity for them to pass article of impeachment in the House, but not transmit it to the Senate and slow things down and actually do let things work through the courts.
So House Democrats, this was on their radar when they set the pace of this impeachment and when they scheduled all of these hearings and now a vote ahead of the holiday recess. Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, he said very explicitly during the introduction of the articles of impeachment that they were not going to wait for the courts and that the courts would not be a deterrent for them. Even though they would like to hear from these witnesses, they were not going to hold off on moving forward and wait for months and months for decisions to be made about individual witnesses. However, that is also an element that is part of the argument of Republicans of the pace of this, that this should be decided by the third branch of government, the judicial system. And they say that Democrats are steamrolling through that.
Paula, what do you think about that?
Again, I think when you look at the GOP leadership on the Senate side, they've been really clear. They want this over with. They want this to just stick to the Democrats. They don't want to be seen as dragging this out any longer. They want to get through this. They are confident the president will not be removed. And then they want to appear as the party that's pivoting back to looking at trade, prescription drug prices, and health care ahead of 2020. I don't see where too many people have the incentive to dig in and really go through a more comprehensive process. And I actually asked Nancy Pelosi about this maybe a week ago at the Kennedy Center honors on the red carpet. I said, look, what do you say to people who argue that you're moving too fast? And she dismissed the criticism and said that, you know, they're doing exactly what they need to do. So I just don't see the incentive for anyone to drag this out any longer.
Hmm. Well, Brian, go ahead, Catherine, quickly.
Senate Republicans are also already saying that they know the outcome and that they don't need to hear from witnesses because they know where their votes are.
Right. Well, to that point, we've got comments on our website. Brian 4000 says, instead of spending all this time on an impeachment that will not get through the Senate, I would rather the Democrats had turned the phone calls into a campaign issue and put it to voters in the election. So, folks, what do you think about that as the House is poised to take a full floor vote on impeachment this week? And then it's on to the Senate. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about what is going to be another big week in the news ahead and an historic week, without a doubt, as the House is poised to take a full floor vote on impeachment. I'm joined today by Paula Reed. She's White House correspondent for CBS News, focusing on justice and legal affairs. Catherine Tully McManus also joins us. She covers Congress and, in particular, congressional leadership for CQ Roll Call. And we want to hear from you. What's your question about this big week in the news about how the impeachment vote will be handled in the House and what might happen when it moves to the Senate? Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, if this process continues on and the Senate goes ahead and ends up acquitting, and then the courts come back and say that the witnesses that are not testifying are, in fact, need to be compelled to testify and respond to the subpoenas, can they reopen the impeachment inquiry?
Steve, thank you for your call. Paula, do you have an answer for that?
I don't know, because they'd already gone through and voted to acquit. I guess it also depends how they sort of resolve things in the Senate. I would say, like so many things in this administration, we have a question of first impression that would likely, if they wanted to pursue it, right? Because there's a legal question. Can you? I don't know. That would probably be something the Supreme Court may have to look at, unless there's a rule I don't know about that just completely bars that. But then there's the political calculation too, right? Because these cases may not resolve until April, potentially even the end of the Supreme Court's term. Do you really want to be reopening an impeachment inquiry in the summer ahead of a presidential election? That's a political calculation.
Let's go. Oh, Catherine, did you want to jump in there?
Some House Democrats have brought up the potential you can impeach a president more than once. So if those witnesses would be relevant to a different line of attack in impeachment, there are some House Democrats that are open to that. I would say they are definitely not the majority. Mm. But that is one option.
Wow. Well, let's get through this week first, right,
yes.
Everybody? Let's go to Claire, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Claire, you're on the air.
Oh, my gosh. Hi, Magna.
Hi, Claire.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Everything you ladies have been discussing, in my opinion, is exactly why all the polls are showing the country virtually split down the middle on this issue. Right now, what we've had so far is a half of a trial. We've had no defense of any sort other than bloviating from the Trump administration. We've got no documents from them, no witnesses. So people are waiting to hear from Trump with some facts, which he obviously doesn't want us to know, which implies he's hiding something. But it's such a mess, and we need answers from Bolton and Mulvaney.
Hmm. Well, Claire, thank you for your call, because Claire brings up a couple of things, and let's dig into them. First of all, Paula, about Claire's observation that the president has essentially brought no defense whatsoever, no witnesses, etc. That just reminds me of I'm thinking about the New York Times editorial from a couple of days ago or last week, where this is according to the Times. The Times editorial board sees the president's approach to these impeachment proceedings as near monarchical because he feels like he doesn't have to offer any kind of defense. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's spot on. I mean, we argue that the president has not provided anything. He would argue that he gave us a transcript of his call and it was perfect. Well, okay, that was a partial transcript of the call and it was not perfect. Right? If you look at this, I mean, even people within his own administration have provided evidence suggesting that there was a larger plan to pressure a foreign government to help the president advance his chances in an upcoming election. There isn't a great defense to those allegations. And that's why the White House's strategy has been to just refuse to cooperate, refuse to give documents, refuse to allow witnesses to participate and allow the president to speak directly to voters with his defense, which for a while was no quid pro quo. And then when more evidence came out, that was modified to be no quo. And then it kind of came out to be some version of, so what if I did? So he has not really been consistent in his own messaging, which is, I think, part of why you're seeing in the polls an increase in the support for impeachment, because he has not been able to put forth a defense. Now, not just him. This is the White House at large. I'm there every day, and I struggle to find people who can provide a coherent explanation for certain events. There does not seem to be a coordinated communications plan, even when they brought on additional people. Pam Bondi, the former attorney general of Florida, she was supposed to help handle the communicating during impeachment, her first interview on CBS, she didn't have a clear view of the facts. She didn't know who the ambassador to the UK was, the European Union versus Ukraine. So there has really just not been a very impressive defense coming out of the White House. And that's what you're seeing reflected in the polls.
But you're also seeing reflected that if it's not an impressive defense, verging on no defense, it has worked to quite stymie the proceedings. I mean, Catherine, what do you think about that?
Absolutely. So it put Congress in a very interesting position because on one hand, the Trump administration and President Trump himself were given the opportunity to participate in the Judiciary Committee proceedings. And so and they opted not to. They said, no, we will not provide witnesses. We will not send anyone to sit and defend the president's actions. However, at the same time, House Republicans on that panel were continually saying, hey, we didn't get a minority witness day. We didn't get the witnesses that we wanted to bring in to defend the president. And that is such a interesting divide because the witnesses they would have wanted to bring in were not White House witnesses to defend the president on the facts. They would have been Hunter Biden and other people of that vein. And so it has created this tension where the White House is not providing the information and Republicans in the House are saying, hey, we're not being allowed to present our side of the story.
Right. Well, so Claire also brought up the fact that there hasn't been any sort of major swing in the polls. I want to talk about one of the most recent polls to come out that got a lot of folks' attention, including the president's. He lashed out against it. This was the Fox News poll from just over the weekend here, saying that according to Fox News in its latest poll, 41% of people they polled said the president should not be impeached. 4% said the president should be impeached but not removed. And 50% said impeached and removed. It's actually, I mean, while those numbers might seem kind of eye-opening, there's hardly any shift from Fox's late October polling to now. So, Paula, what do you think about that?
That's what we've seen over the past several weeks. Most people have a lot of fatigue over impeachment. They're kind of just sick of it. It blankets the airwaves, your airwaves, my airwaves, and people just have fatigue. They have their opinion. And right now it's just, well, how long before people turn on House Democrats, for example, for dragging this out before their sentiment shifts to, well, why aren't you doing more to help us? It appears that people's opinions of what transpired here are pretty ingrained. And people overall, I think it's less really having a strong opinion and more in my experience talking to voters, just fatigue with the whole process. So it's not like they were really dialed into the most recent report and found that detail that finally just shifted their allegiance the other way.
Yeah. But if you dig into the numbers a little bit, Catherine, I mean, first of all, another way to look at it is when you add that, let me just make sure I have the numbers right. When you add that 50 plus 4, you get 54% of Americans, according to Fox News, saying that the president should be impeached. But as we dig even further down, apparently there's in this poll, there's a 16-point margin where voters are more likely to say that Republicans are simply protecting the president, whether or not they truly believe what he did was impeachable. I mean, what do you make of that?
I think one of the really interesting things in this poll is that that 4% number who would like to see impeachment in the House but not removal in the Senate, to only have 4% of the population be happy with what is right now the most likely outcome, that just shows you how dissatisfied everyone is with this process. And the fatigue is very real, and people are tired of hearing about it and would like to hear more about the issues that are front and center, for example, on the campaign trail, healthcare, the economy, jobs, etc. But 4% is a tiny, tiny number. And to have those be the people who would like to see what is ultimately going to happen is demoralizing for everyone on each side.
Mm. Well, let's go to Steve, who's calling from Glastonbury, Connecticut. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello, folks. Nice to talk to you today. There's such a microscopic approach to this that I'm beginning to wonder if we're missing the bigger picture here. In the end, because the Senate is Republican controlled, they're going to vote them out anyway. They're not going to allow the articles of impeachment to go through. So to me, it looks as if the Democratic Party is simply trying to get this on record so that when the 2020 elections come around, they can pull these pieces of paper out and say, why should we elect you? Look, you have two articles of impeachment against you. There's a lot of meat and content that's been discussed just in the last 10 minutes, things that have to do with innocent until proven guilty. When you talk with the woman who mentioned that it's like half a trial, yeah, it is kind of like the grand jury. I served on a grand jury. I know what that's about. All the facts are being put together so that they can present a case. They've presented their case. They've created the basic documents for the beginning of this process. He is innocent until proven guilty. If you want to hang on to these things as evidence at the time of the 2020 election. That makes perfect sense. But I don't think that dissecting it any deeper than that is helping the American people whatsoever.
Right. Well, Steve, thank you for your call. Paula, what do you think?
No, it's an apt analogy, the grand jury as the House. But then when we move into the Senate, the idea that this is similar to an average group of jurors, I think that's just not true, because most jurors are not depending on the accused to help them campaign for reelection. So the argument that any of these jurors in the centers in the Senate are impartial, it's just not realistic. It's not where we are in the process. We kind of already know. That's why we know the outcome, right? He has the majority in the Senate. So even before they officially started, they're like, well, there's no reason that they'll remove them. But in terms of delving into the details, look, for me, I cover the White House. For my colleague here, you cover the Hill. These are our jobs. Our job is to cover the day in and day out process. This is one of the most significant things that the country can do. It's a very solemn responsibility for Congress. It's enormous for the White House, the implications for him, for his agenda. We do have to cover it day in and day out. I know there is fatigue, but this is an important process and certainly newsworthy. And it's not for us to judge what is and is not important.
Certainly newsworthy is underplaying it, Paula. I mean, like, if we're honest, this is historic. This has only happened a tiny handful of times in the history of this nation. But I want to just get the voices through tape of some of the folks in Congress who are dealing with this issue as we speak and what they've been saying in recent days. So first of all, here's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. He was on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday saying he has heard enough to know which way he's going to vote when the Senate has, or is likely to have, its trial on impeachment.
I'm not trying to hide the fact that I have disdain for the accusations in the process, so I don't need any witnesses. The president can make a request to call witnesses. They can make a request to call Mike Pence and Pompeo and Joe Biden and Hunter Biden. I am ready to vote on the underlying articles. I don't really need to hear a lot of witnesses.
So that's Senator Graham saying it doesn't matter what happens in the trial, he knows how he's going to vote. I should say, so several Democrats have also said something similar. But there's been a lot of attention being paid, and we've talked about it here, to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell talking about how there's going to be no difference between how he runs a Senate trial and what the White House wants. Here's Senator Ted Cruz, Texas Republican, on ABC's This Week yesterday, saying there's nothing wrong or unusual about that.
Senators are not required, like jurors in a criminal trial, to be sequestered, not to talk to anyone, not to coordinate. There's no prohibition. And by the way, past trials, you look at the Clinton impeachment trials, the Senate Democrats were all talking with the Clinton White House. You look at this impeachment trial, the House Democrats are all talking with the Senate Democrats. This remains a political process.
And we've got some reaction here from Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, a Democrat, on CNN's State of the Union this weekend, saying that he's disappointed with this approach from his GOP colleagues.
For the leader of the United States Senate, Mitch McConnell, to say he's coordinating with the White House to make sure he's not convicted and removed is, it really is part of this see no evil, hear no evil. It's why I'm so disappointed in my colleagues, is see no evil, hear no evil attitude.
Catherine, how different is, or is it all that different, Senator McConnell's approach to what Democrats did during the impeachment of President Clinton?
Well, I think that it's important to understand that McConnell's coordination with the White House has been pretty much the plan all along. And actually, it is something that Senate Republicans would like to see more often, not just on impeachment, but on everything. Getting on the same page with the White House for Senate Republicans is a daily challenge. They are sometimes announcing priorities for the week or priorities going ahead on legislative issues, or announcing that they've come to a deal on something, only to have that progress thwarted by the White House or the president saying, just kidding, that's not the deal that I want. So by announcing this coordination ahead of time, it does put the pressure on the White House to then stick to the story.
Mm. Paula Reed, I'm going to give you a chance to answer that, but also we've got 2 minutes left, and I want to hear a little bit about your conversation with Rudy Giuliani.
Well, Giuliani was at the White House for about 2 hours on Friday, which was quite a surprise, because not only is he central in the events leading up to impeachment, but he's also under investigation by the Justice Department, the Trump Justice Department. He remains one of the president's personal attorneys. But to bring him to the White House for 2 hours on that historic day, that was pretty surprising. So I gave him a call. And we talked for a little while. And he told me that he's not going to discuss exactly what he and the president discussed. But he said, look, the president is not too down about this. He told me one funny quote. He says he has, quote, the strength you'd have when you're an innocent man. Like me, of course, referring to Giuliani. And I asked the mayor if he wanted to participate in a Senate trial. He said that he would love to participate in a Senate trial if he was asked. He acknowledged that they're still not quite sure what exactly they're going to do there. But he said that particularly his cross-examination skills would come in handy, but didn't really seem to acknowledge in any way his role and how key he is in a lot of the evidence against his client. But look, he continues to be a member of the president's team. The president believes that he brings gravitas to his defense. And Giuliani just came back from a trip to Ukraine.
I was going
to
ask you, this briefcase full of stuff.
He brought a, quote, briefcase full of stuff. And I pressed him on that. I thought that was hyperbole. I was like, really, a briefcase? And he got defensive. He told me the exact store he went to in Vienna to purchase this roller bag. So we'll take him at his word. But he would not reveal if he actually shared any of this evidence with the president. So I'm actually going to be at an event with the president shortly, and we'll have a chance to ask him just that, if he has shared any of this evidence that he gathered with the president and what they plan to do with it.
Well, Paula Reed, White House correspondent for CBS News, focusing on the Justice Department and legal affairs. Paula, always great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Catherine Talia McManus, who covers Congress and congressional leadership in particular for CQ Roll Call. It was great to have you as well, Catherine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk with presidential hopeful Senator Michael Bennet. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Michael Bennet, Senator of Colorado, is still in the race for the Democratic nomination for president. He set his sights on New Hampshire, and he's going all in. He is polling a bit low, and he hasn't been on the debate stage since July. But on the other hand, he's outlasted some other previous Democratic hopefuls who had a lot more name recognition and a lot more money. Remember when Representative Beto O'Rourke and California Senator Kamala Harris were in the race? But the question now is Michael Bennet's moderate message being crowded out by other candidates with a lot more name recognition, again, and money, like Senator Amy Klobuchar or Mayor Pete Buttigieg or Vice President Joe Biden? So we're going to talk to Senator Bennet about this right now. And what's your question for him? Find us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Colorado Senator Michael Bennet joins us now. Senator Bennet, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, give us the state of the campaign right now. How's it going, and where are you focusing your efforts?
Well, we're focusing our efforts in New Hampshire, although we've got a great team in Iowa that's working hard there as well. I built my campaign to last until people were actually starting to make up their mind and until people actually started to vote. And what I'd say is the state of the campaign is more open today than it was 6 weeks ago, than it was 6 months ago, and then it was a year ago. People in these early states quite rightly are trying to figure out who the right candidate is to beat Donald Trump. And I think their assessment of the frontrunners is that they're worried that they won't be able to beat Donald Trump. And that's why I've remained in the race. I think it's critical for us to nominate somebody who can win in purple states and beat Donald Trump and make him a one-term president.
So tell me more then about what you're hearing specifically, since you're all in on New Hampshire, what you're hearing from those primary voters about how deep that concern is.
It's very, very deep. I mean, you know, I wish Joe Biden well in everything that he does. I think he's done an amazing amount of good work for this country. But I think what I'm hearing in New Hampshire is people are ready for a new generation of leadership. I think they are concerned that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren's ideological commitments are ones that won't travel very well from the East Coast. Every day that passes, there are actually more undecided voters. So we're going to make a big push here. We're going to try to raise some money this month and get it on air in New Hampshire. And in the meantime, I'm going to do 50 town halls in the hope that I might be able to catch on the way my friend John McCain and others have done in New Hampshire in the past.
Hmm. So I wonder then, Senator Bennett, if you'd be willing to be vocally critical of the Democratic, the party as a whole and how it structures the primary season, and also, say, the rules around who makes it to a debate stage. Because if what you're saying is fundamentally true, that what voters are truly concerned about is who Democratic voters are concerned about is who could beat the president. And yet the whole system in the primaries seems to be built around producing a candidate or a nominee that may not be that person. Don't you have a fundamental problem?
There's no question about it. I mean, first of all, what I am saying is fundamentally true. And I'm my daughter, Caroline, said to me once, Dad, when I was thinking about running for president, she said, if you run and tell the truth and you lose, no one can fault you for it. And I said, well, that's good, Caroline, because there's really no other reason for me to run. And I don't think there's any other way for me to win. I think it does point up how incredibly ridiculous and counterproductive the DNC debate rules used to be. I used to complain about them, and I thought I was completely self-serving when I was complaining about them. Now I think this, you know, for the sake of the party, and for the country, they should change the rules that they have. And this is preposterous. And ask any reporter who's covering New Hampshire or Iowa, and they'll tell you what I just said, which is people have not made up their minds. In fact, they're farther away from making up their minds today than they have been, which is why the idea that the DNC would prematurely cleave people off the debate stage, make it harder for them to raise money if they're not celebrity candidates, I think in the end doesn't serve the party terribly well. I spent a lot of the weekend on airplanes reading a copy of Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, the Hunter S. Thompson account of the 72 election, which a friend of mine gave me. And it's like we can't learn a lesson, the same lesson over and over again, which is these races are completely uncertain until voters go to the voting booths. And I think with Donald Trump in the White House, it only heightens the uncertainty.
Interesting. Well, Senator Bennett, though, I'm wondering, obviously you see yourself as quite a different candidate from Senator Elizabeth Warren or Senator Bernie Sanders. But how would you say you differentiate yourself and what you might offer from Senator Amy Klobuchar or Mayor Pete Buttigieg?
Well, I think with Mayor Pete, we just have vastly different experience. I mean, we both started out at the local level, but my school district had a budget that was three times the size of Mayor Pete's town. And I've been in the Senate for 10 years since then, which is enough time to understand how to get some things done, but also what the nature of the corruption in Washington really is and what we really have to do to overcome it as a country. You know, we're not going to fix this in Washington. Washington's not going to fix itself. We have to build a constituency for change in this country to address issues like climate change and close over a broken Washington, D.C. I think that's going to be very hard for somebody from the outside to understand, or somebody with that, you know, little experience in national politics. I think with Amy, we just have different experiences before coming to the Senate. Our politics are similar, but I was a school superintendent. She was, and also a lawyer. She was a prosecuting attorney in Minnesota. I think the experience of being a superintendent of a major urban school district in this country, 95,000 kids, most of whom are kids of color, most of whom are kids living in poverty, gives a person a sense of the profound injustice that exists in our society today, that this is not a political game for most people that live in the country, that we're living at a time when we've had 50 years of economic immobility for most people in the United States, so they can't afford some combination of housing, health care, higher education, or early childhood education. For the parents that I once worked for in the Denver Public Schools, you know, they're killing themselves. And no matter what they do, they cannot get their kids out of poverty. So I think I just have a vastly different set of experiences than the people that are running, and therefore a vastly different perspective about what the nature of the kind of, as I said earlier, the corruption in our mm-hmm. system and what we have to do to overcome it. And by the way, this includes two wars that we have fought with for the last 20 years with absolutely no accountability to the American people, which have been futile exercises and should never have been started or never lasted 20 years and never, I hope, will never be repeated.
Well, no accountability, and as you well know, according to the Washington Post's stunning series of investigative pieces, a campaign of misleading and misinformation, outright lies to the American people.
It's absolutely staggering when you read. I read all six of those articles over the weekend, and you know, people say, "Well, why have people lost faith in our government?" I mean, my God, you know, when you see something like that. There's a reason why people have lost faith, and there's a reason why they decided to send a reality TV star to Washington to blow the place up. And the question before us now is whether that's good enough for the country. Is that good enough for our kids and our grandkids and America's place in the world? I don't think it is, which is why we have to do everything we can to make this guy a one-term president, figure out how to inject some accountability back into our systems, overcome the special interests, and learn how to govern our country again. That's what we have to do.
Well, had you been on the debate stage for the past several Democratic debates, folks would have had a chance to see sort of how you differentiate yourself or more specifics about your particular plans and policies should you become the nominee here. So let me just ask you, what's your take on sort of the big sweeping bold ideas or the plans, say, coming from Senator Warren, Senator Sanders about Medicare for all?
Right. I actually think, and people can go to michaelbennett.com and read my plans. I think that my plans cohere in a way that their plans don't. When I think about 10 years of town halls in Colorado, which, by the way, is a state that's exactly a third Democratic and a third Republican and a third Independent. I think about people, you know, saying we can't afford a middle-class life because we can't afford housing, health care, higher education, or early childhood education. That's what my plans are focused on. You know, the American Family Act, which I wrote with Sherrod Brown several years ago, that bill alone would cut childhood poverty by 40% in 1 year. It would end $2-a-day poverty for kids living in America, which is a disgrace that this country persists in. You know, I'd rather cut childhood poverty in 1 year than spend the next 10 years fighting a losing battle for Medicare for all. You know, I understand Bernie and Elizabeth's ideological commitment is much more recent to this than Bernie's, but Bernie has been committed to this since 1970, and I understand and respect his ideological commitment to it. I do not want to spend the next 10 years fighting a losing battle for Medicare for all when we could dramatically reduce childhood poverty in this country, when we could start to work to improve our education system so that we're actually liberating kids from their economic circumstances instead of shackling to them, which is what we're doing today, which is why Bernie's promise and Elizabeth's promise of free college is really so irrelevant. What we need in this country is free preschool, not free college, and we got to figure out how to take the 70% of kids who graduate from high school and never can earn anything but the minimum wage and put them in the position to earn a living wage. And I'd like to spend the next 10 years addressing climate change. Mm. And those things are not going to be able to be addressed if we continue to lose elections to climate deniers and we continue to lose elections in purple states. I do not believe my set of proposals are a moderate set of proposals. I think they're an incredibly progressive set of proposals that can unite not just the Democratic base, but some of the 9 million people that voted twice for Barack Obama and once for Donald Trump. And I think that's the big difference between having run in Colorado twice and having run in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts or having run in Vermont.
Mm. Well, we got a comment here on Facebook. Justin Barney says, I actually like Senator Bennett. His proposal of lowering the age of Medicare eligibility to 50 and increasing subsidies to the Affordable Care Act is something that a Democratic-controlled Congress could pass purely through reconciliation. What do you think about that?
Well, I appreciate Justin saying he actually likes me. It sounded like he might be surprised by that. But look, we've got – there are a number of ways to skin the cat on universal coverage that don't require us to make private insurance illegal in the country. And by the way, I'm not carrying a brief for the private insurance companies. If Bernie were here, he might say, Michael, why are you defending the private insurance companies? I'm not. I could care less. I'm defending the need to get to universal health care in this country as quickly as we can. And I do not think you're going to persuade the American people to give up their choice of buying private insurance if they want it. 90% of people in Massachusetts, I saw in a recent poll, don't want to give up that choice. And they certainly don't want to give it up for the privilege of paying $31 trillion in new taxes, which is what Bernie and Elizabeth proposed, a modified version of that, have proposed. I think we could cover everybody in America in 3 years with my plan called Medicare X, which is a public option that would be available to everybody, starting in rural areas and then moving over to everybody else over the course of 3 years. And one thing we haven't talked about much on the debate stage or anything else is the cost of healthcare, which, frankly, is the real problem in America. And the fact that we're spending twice as much as any other industrialized country in the world is spending and getting a worse result should suggest to us there's a huge opportunity here for us to improve the lives of the American people and put us in the position of having the federal government spend less money on healthcare and more money on the next generation of Americans who have been completely shortchanged over the last 30 years.
Mm. Well, just as a point here, Senator Bennett, as you well know, Senator Warren would say, you mentioned all the major new taxes that would come with a Medicare for All plan. Her camp has been saying very clearly, and her plan says very clearly, those costs would be mitigated by the overall reduced cost that would be in the laps of the average American family, that those costs would be radically reduced. So just
I agree that she agree that she says that, but empty promises are not going to get us where we need to be. All that's going to create is more cynicism about our political system when that's what we need the least.
Mm. Let's just take a quick call here.
And by the way, you just need to ask the voters of Vermont. I mean, they tried to pass it up there, Bernie's home state, and they rejected it because they were not going to pay a 10% increase in taxes. The businesses weren't going to pay an 11% increase in taxes. It's the reason it was rejected in Colorado 80-20 and why California couldn't even get it started. So I'm unpersuaded by her math.
Okay. Well,
but not unpersuaded at the need for us to get to universal health care, which we desperately have to do.
I was going to go to a call here, but I'll just borrow the caller Jim's question because we're running out of time here. But Jim wants to know.
I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. Jim wants to know, what's your plan for attacking the national debt?
It's a great question. And I think it's something that we've heard incredibly small amounts from. We have got to stop doing what we're doing, first of all. So since 2001, we've borrowed $5 trillion from the Chinese for the privilege of giving the richest people in America tax cuts. That is absurd. And all that's done is increase the income inequality that we've had. We've spent $5.6 trillion on 20 years of wars in the Middle East, which we now learn from the war college in the case of Iraq was a war that only Iran won. In the case of Afghanistan, has been a disaster from beginning to end. And we need to stop doing that. We've got to reduce the health care costs in this country because, as I said, we're spending twice as much as any other industrialized country in the world. I think if we start to do those things, we can begin to dig ourselves out of a very unfortunate situation we're in. There are people in this campaign who are saying that deficits don't matter. You know, I disagree with that. We're at 0% interest rates. When they go back to a normal level of like 4%, we're going to be spending all our money on interest and not, as I said earlier, on the next generation. And the next generation should be furious with us because We've got $22 trillion of debt on the balance sheet, and our investment in them has been cut by 35% since Ronald Reagan was president. The worst of all worlds for them.
We've got to
address it.
We've got literally 30 seconds to go. I just want to quickly ask you. You've talked about John McCain going all in New Hampshire. Gary Hart famously did that too, but so did John Huntsman, and he put everything in New Hampshire, and he couldn't do better than third. So, you know, it's not a guarantee.
Nothing's a guarantee. Hope springs eternal. I hope people will come out to my town halls.
Well,
thanks, Meghna.
Senator Michael Bennett, 2020 presidential, Democratic presidential candidate and senator from Colorado as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.